Hello, welcome to My Camino, the podcast. I'm Dan Mullins. It's great to have your company for yet another week. A very special thank you to my new Patreon sponsors, Joe and Daniel. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. If you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, just go to patreon.com/Dan Mullins to help keep the show on the road. Wow, what an incredible response to last week's chat with Joe and Savannah Kuro. Thanks for your feedback, your encouragement and support. I really appreciate it. This is a podcast about El Camino de Santiago, or the Way of St. James. The Camino is a pilgrimage. You could say most people walk it for the adventure of heading out your front door on a long walk in a foreign country, and that alone is worth the journey. But as Savannah Kuro told us last week, and this was a young person's perspective, there are a lot of people on the Camino hoping the pilgrimage helps them deal with some form of malaise. And it's in the freedom of simply walking day after day westward toward the horizon that we find time to contemplate and perhaps find a clarity to clear some of the storm clouds gathering above us. Some people will charge out early in the day to secure a bed in the town they've chosen for the night. Others, like Joe and Savannah last week, will go long and go slow. Some have all the latest and greatest gear. Others walk in tennis shoes. Some play music from boom boxes. Others prefer to listen to the crunching of the ground beneath their feet, the birdsong or the cowbells. You'll meet pilgrims who have walked from the UK, from Germany, the Netherlands. I met a Polish pilgrim who had walked from Krakow. You'll hear often, "It's your Camino. Walk the pilgrimage as you choose," and rightly so. You haven't travelled halfway around the world to be told what to do. You need to find your balance and rhythm to make the most of the opportunity. And you almost owe it to yourself to make the most of the opportunity. If it is some sort of malaise that led you to the Camino, why not make the most of that time for change? I have two quotes from two former US presidents 2 weeks in a row. John F. Kennedy said, "When written in Chinese, the word crisis is composed of two characters. One represents danger and the other represents opportunity." There are plenty who walk the Camino for the pure joy of the environment. Indeed, some of the pictures out of that part of the world this week have been startling with the heat wave and the wildfires. So what if you wanted your Camino to be completely off the scale? What if you wanted to challenge yourself to conduct a sort of extreme Camino, like winding your way from St. Jean-Pied-de-Port to Santiago in just 14 days? British pilgrims Danny Nichols, Michael Geary and Tom Pilling ran from St. Jean-Pied-de-Port to Santiago. They're on the line. Welcome, pilgrims.
Hello.
Hello.
Now, Danny, I'll start with you. Where did the idea to run the Camino come from?
The blame lies with Michael and Tom, actually. I had nothing to do with coming up with this mad idea. I'm going to hand over to Tom and Michael to give you the background to this.
Okay, so Tom, Michael, where did the idea to run the Camino come from?
It actually came from probably back in 2019. I did a challenge to run from London to Paris, which was 7 marathons in 7 days. And Tom was my one-man support crew. And when we were driving back in the van, when we were driving home, he said, I need to do one now. And Tom had previously walked the Camino twice. So he said, "Why don't we go run it?" And at the time I thought, "Oh, I don't know, it's a bit far, you know, is it possible?" And then we talked about it a little bit more. And then it kind of, we wanted to do it probably 2020 or even 2021. Obviously with the pandemic, we couldn't travel. So it got pushed back to this year. So, yeah, that's where it comes from. And like Dan said, I lay the blame with Tom.
So, Tom, let me ask you, what was the appeal of the Camino? If you walked it 2 times before you ran it, it must hold some allure for you.
Yeah, I think anybody who's ever done it, they'll say how special it is, and everybody has their time on it and they meet their people, and it's just time for yourself, I suppose, and yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah. So, Michael, I'll go back to you. You talked about the fact that you've run from London to Paris. So are all three of you super fit, long-distance runners? Is it all part of your lives?
I guess all kind of slightly different journeys, really, with different fitness. And I think both me and Dan probably picked it up at a similar time, really, where it was, you know, it became part of our lives probably 5 or 6 years ago. And it kind of escalated from picking running up again after a long break to going, okay, right, let's run 10K, let's do a half marathon, let's do a marathon, let's do some ultras. And, you know, it kind of escalated then into the 7 marathons and then escalated again to a whole new level with the Camino.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, Dan. What did other pilgrims make of you rushing past them?
It's mixed emotions, isn't it? Well, mixed feelings when you go past people or where you stop for a minute to eat, because you're on your feet for 36 miles a day, 37 miles a day. We're stopping and eating. And the first thing that people say to you is, well, where's your luggage? You know, because yeah. We had somebody taking our luggage for us, picking our luggage up in the morning. We were on the road from 6:30 in the morning till, you know, 6-7 o'clock at night. And we were fortunate to have somebody take our luggage from A to B for us, so we didn't have to carry it. So we just had like our ultra backpacks on,
yeah,
with all our liquids, food, suntan lotion, Tiger Balm, painkillers, all what we needed to get through that day. And then, you know, sometimes you'd stop, speak to another pilgrim if they were on the road, have a little chat. And the first thing they'd say was, where's your luggage? Where's your luggage? And it was almost like they frowned upon it that you didn't have luggage. And then you'd tell them, well, where have you come from? And you go, yeah, Saint-Jean. Well, when? You're like, 3 days ago, 4 days ago. And they're like, no, no. Like, well, how have you done that? And they're like, nobody believes you. Nobody believes that you've done it. And then you show them the back of your shirt. You've got your not your sponsors, but our charity page on the back, and you explain what you're doing it for and why you're doing it. And I think the respect that you get from people. So it's like, yeah, you frowned upon it first, and then the respect at the end of the conversation, it turns around 360 in a matter of a minute, really, which is beautiful. And the amount of people that, you know, we went past along the way, that, you know, ended up sponsoring us as well and sending money a couple of days later to our respective charity page, which was fantastic.
Yeah, I want to get to that because that's what it's all about, really. You guys are challenging yourselves, sure, but there's a deeper message to it all. So you talked there, Danny, about 6 to 6, like that's 12 hours of running. So, Michael, you might answer this question. Had you planned it all out? How far did you plan to run each day? And did you stick to that plan? Like, was it strategic in as much as you knew how far you had to go? Or were you like other pilgrims, let's just see how the day pans out?
No, we had it mapped out. We'd done quite a bit of research into it and found some pretty useful sort of resources online where there was, you know, PDFs of the route with the elevations, with the different little towns and villages along the way, and showed you what sort of amenities were in each place. So yeah. I'd basically mapped each day so that we could finish in a place that had hostels, hotels, you know, bed and breakfast type thing. So we had it pretty much mapped out. We pretty much stuck to it the whole way. There was maybe a couple of days where we ended up going slightly further, or then, you know, where we kind of were able to balance that out and go slightly shorter the next day. But yeah, roughly, we pretty much stuck to the plan.
So, Tom, a lot of the paths, now I'm thinking for myself, the trail down after Aldo de Pedron outside of Pamplona, that kind of walk down is really difficult terrain. Walking is difficult terrain. I know I walked with a couple of pilgrims who, that was the first time they'd sort of mentioned to me that they wish they had walking poles, because you would have been able to sort of take some of the pressure off your heels and your knees and your ankles. How do you cope with the different surfaces if you're running?
I suppose you just got to get on with it, I suppose. You've got to take your time, make sure you're not going to injure yourself and go over on your ankles. But, you know, we all have our injuries at certain points, and it hurt, but that was a part of it. We had to endure those paths. And yeah, sometimes you welcome different terrain, because if you're on the road all day and you're just hitting the same pattern over and over, it's nice to jump on a gravel path or a stone path where you have to change your running gait, or yeah, it relieves it as well. But yeah, I think I'm going to speak for these two. There's moments when it hurt going downhill.
Yeah, but how do you prepare for that? I can imagine that you're in the UK, you're running on roads, perhaps you're running on a bit of grass, but I can't imagine you're running on the kind of surface that you would have experienced coming out of Pamplona. I mean, that's broken rocks and it's really heavy.
It's very flat where we are as well. There's no hills to be running around here. We've done a few trips to Macclesfield Forest, haven't we? I don't think you can prepare for it. We just had to be aware that it was going to be like that and it'd be over, and then there'll be another bit of path further down the road.
Yeah. What about shoes? What shoes did you wear, Danny?
So I had two pairs of shoes. I had a pair of two pairs of ASICS trainers, but they were quite big soles, quite foamy. And the reason why I had two is because it takes 24, 48 hours for the foam to kind of go back to the place it originally was when you've been on your feet for so long. So yeah. I was just alternating each day.
When you talked earlier about not taking your belongings with you, had a very small pack with you, you had a support crew then, clearly. Is that support crew also kind of like medical, Michael? Are they being able to strap your ankles and work on your hamstrings and try to give you some respite? If you're running 12 hours a day, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, the support crew were mainly there for kind of, you know, like Dan said, to transport the rest of our luggage, so our kind of spare kit, spare shoes, you know, clothes, etc., from one point to the next. You know, most days they drop in sort of halfway through and meet us at lunch, and we could kind of, you know, like the first couple of days it was really wet, so we were able to chuck wet stuff in and grab some fresh stuff out of the car. But generally that was kind of the way it went. It was kind of, they'd pick stuff up in the morning, we'd be long gone by the time they got up and got into our room and took our stuff. And from a medical perspective, yeah, we put some demands on them to go and stock us up with, you know, ibuprofen or Tiger Balm or, you know, blister plasters and things like that. But in terms of actual treatment, we didn't kind of take a physio with us or anything like that. I mean, kind of managed that ourselves, and we had foam rollers, and we attempted, especially the first few days, to do ice baths in the evening, which Danny made us endure. and, you know, we'd try and sort of stretch and foam roll, and and that was it, really.
Michael, tell me something. What did you find most challenging?
I think there's so many different factors that make this challenging. I think, you know, the pure distance itself is obviously ridiculously challenging. We're talking, you know, 14 ultramarathons in a row. To do one ultramarathon is hard enough. But then you add to that the elevation. You know, you look, day one was like 6,500 feet of elevation. And then day two, you're thinking, oh, it's a bit flatter and it's still like 3,500-4,000 feet. So the elevation adds an extra level. I think the terrain you mentioned earlier makes it in places quite challenging and can make it quite slow to move. I think for us as well, like it's the sheer number of days. I think, you know, I'd done 7 days in a row before, but by the time we got to day seven, thinking, wow, we're only halfway through. So you know, the sheer number of days to keep doing that makes it really challenging. And, you know, I think we all had different injuries at different points. I went through probably 2 or 3 days where I was genuinely close to chucking the towel in, and I thought I wasn't going to be able to do it. So dealing with pain and dealing with injuries, but having to push through and keep going, that was a real challenge.
And I'll stay with you then, Michael. What about, did all three of you run every step?
No, it was a combination of running and walking. We kind of agreed before we went out that we knew, you know, there's going to be some big, steep climbs. And, you know, even if you look at some of the most experienced, you know, even, you know, elite level ultra runners, you know, they don't run every step of the way, you know, because it's such a drain on energy that actually you can probably walk fairly quickly, pretty much the same speed uphill as you can, you know, running or tempt, you know, sort of jogging up a hill. You can probably take, you know, the same amount of speed and use less energy. And it gives your running muscles a break as well. Cause, you know, when you start walking, you're using different muscle groups. So we knew that, we'd agreed that before we went out. So anything that was flat and down, we tried to run. Anything that was up, you know, we would walk up. And you know, that was kind of the plan.
I'd say the first couple of miles each day was so tough, because you'd wake up in the morning, and that's what I found the toughest each morning, getting out of bed, your whole body aching, you'd not slept because I found my hips were just pounding, one of my ankles had swollen up, blistered, I had 12 blisters at one point. And in the morning, I just wanted out. I didn't want to carry on anymore. And I looked at the other two, and I just thought, well, if they're going to do it, I've got to do it. Obviously, there's the funds that are there as well, so that keeps you going. But for that first couple of miles each day, you're walking and just finding your rhythm. And then you're kind of like combating with the pain, and you're trying to talk yourself to get through the pain. Like, I was arguing with my blisters. I'm not going to let you stop me. I'm not going to let you stop me. And then you get to the first like kind of like decline, and then you start to move your legs a little bit quicker. And then you start to think, okay, I've got this. I can start to run a little bit. And then throughout the day, then you just find yourself running again. But each morning I thought, I've not got a run in me. I've not even got a walk in me. On day, was it day 8 or 9, Geary, when you were in bits, mate, you couldn't even walk to the bathroom. And we tried to sit him down and say, listen, it's day 9. You've done a fantastic job. If there's going to be risk to injury now, you need to get in the car, have a day in the car. And he was like, I can't do it. And, you know, the steps were so small at first. And then after a couple of miles, we were like, oh, my God, I can't believe you're running, mate. I can't believe you're running. It was crazy, crazy.
Yeah. Wow, what a great story. Danny, I'll stay with you. If I thought I liked the idea of a running Camino, what sort of training regime would I need to reach before I go? Would I need to be running for 12 hours a day?
No, so how do you train for 14 ultra marathons? And the answer is you can't. You know, I am a bit of an ultra runner, and I've trained for ultra runs. And they do say, and as part of my training plan, about a month before an event, so I've done like a 50-mile ultra run. And what they do say is that you probably want to get around about 80% of your target, but split over two runs over 2 days. So I did one weekend before my 50 miler. I did a 20 miler on a Saturday, 20 miler on a Sunday. And that's training for a 1 day ultra. They also say, again, this is in the running community, that once you've done an ultra, you need at least 2 to 4 weeks to recover. We were getting up the next day and doing another ultra run for 14 days, which is, again, every time I look back on this, I didn't realise before we did it, but now when I look back on it, it's pretty ridiculous what we did.
Yeah.
I don't think there's very many people that have done such a ridiculous thing. So therefore, I don't think there is a way of properly training for it.
Yeah, yeah. If I'm on the Camino, I walk about between 3.5 to 4 kilometres an hour. Oh, how fast are you guys running?
Probably not a lot. Probably not much quicker.
I think we were. I think if you think about it, we were stopping every 6 miles, weren't we?
Yeah.
or you know, you've got, it's all about fueling as well.
Yeah.
So it's all about making sure your energy levels were there, which I think we had at the end of each day, because I think we did fuel right. What our struggle was, our legs, weren't they? They were the problem. So yeah, I don't know what speed, maybe about 6 kilometers an hour, 6.5.
Yeah. 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 I struggle with kilometers.
Right.
Feeling minutes per mile, but
right.
I think if you're talking minutes per mile, I'd say over the course of the 2 weeks that we probably would average our sort of running pace was, really easy running pace. Obviously you've got to keep what you can, sure, in the tank. We're probably running 10, 11 minute miles.
Oh, okay. All right. Right, that's still pretty quick,
but not quick. We're kind of going as but steady, slow and steady, and that was part of the training as well. That was, I think, for both me and Dan was a bit of an adaptation to training, to go like, I'm not training for a marathon where I'm pushing, race pace or anything. It was like, let's just go slow and steady and train slow and steady to get used to it. And I think kind of we both benefited from Tom's experience of walking it before. And, Tom was kind of saying to us, look, it's just slow and steady. Like, it's, part of your training needs to be time on your feet, so going for big walks. So some days I'd go for a 10 mile run, but then I'd go out for a 2 hour walk straight after it.
Right.
You're getting kind of 3-4 hours out on your feet.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a famous story in Australia about an ultra marathon runner. His name was Cliff Young. I don't know if you chaps have heard of him. He was a potato farmer from Victoria, and Westfield is the big shopping center place in Australia, right? They have the big malls, shopping malls, Westfield. And they decided to host a race between Westfield Parramatta in Sydney and Westfield Doncaster in Melbourne. It was 1983. I remember it like it was yesterday. And this potato farmer, who was then 61 years old, his name was Cliff Young, turned up to compete in the ultra marathon, running 875 kilometers in overalls and gumboots. And he ran the whole thing nonstop.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
So everyone became aware of this fellow after about day two, and the whole country was glued to their televisions. This guy is running in overalls and gumboots overnight, and all the TV crews are, he's still running. It's on the next night on the news. Everyone's in front of the TV. Is this guy still running?
Mm-hmm.
And he won the race, I think, by 10 hours in the end or something. But he had this and he ran, I think, I still remember it now. He ran 4 miles an hour. Yeah.
Yeah, so he's doing like 15-minute miles.
Yeah. 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 So that, all those years
in boots.
Yeah. In gumboots, exactly. So Tom, let me go back to you. It's insane. It's insane. It's a classic Australian story. There's been movies about him and all sorts of stuff. Tom, I spoke earlier about the Camino's reputation for providing an opportunity for pilgrims to do a bit of soul searching, and you'd be aware of that reputation. I'm sure you walked it twice yourself before. Did you experience the same sort of energy or transformation? Did you even have time to kind of pause and smell the roses?
I think, we are traveling slowly as runners, but there is something you miss when you're running it. I found anyway, you don't have that time to, you might see somebody in the day and have a chat with them, but if you're walking, you might see that person again or in a couple of days, or you keep on meeting them down the path. But when running, it's a glimpse of people's stories, really, that you meet and you have a quick chat and you might not see them again.
Yeah.
So there is something you missed. I think that's something so special on the Camino is meeting the people and finding out about other people. So yeah, it was definitely the same. But like you say, we're doing it our own way, like everybody does. But we did it for three great charities.
The only people who could keep up with us that we kept that we saw on multiple occasions were people on bikes.
Yeah.
So our mate Felipe that we saw, who had ridden from his house in Switzerland and then was riding the Camino. We saw him quite a few times because he was on a bike, so he could cover similar mileage. But yeah, there was one night we met there was a Scottish lady in the restaurant we were eating in, and she said, "Oh, we saw you guys this morning." She said, "How have you got here? Like, are you doing it on bikes?" And we're like, "Oh no, we're running." She said, "What? I came in a car, and I've only just got here." And we were like, "Yeah, okay." Like, she sort of looked at us like, "Nah, there's no way you're running. You must be on bikes or in a car." And we're like, "Nah, we're on foot. Promise."
That's so great. What about, you talked about blisters? Perhaps Michael, I'll throw this question to you. If you're walking and you've got to deal with blisters or even shin splints, even knee pain, it's often one of those things that you think, well, I don't know if I can keep going. How are you running with blisters and shin splints and knee pain? Running is an entirely different thing and much more difficult to get your pace or set your pace to enable you to kind of manage the pain.
Yeah, I think the thing with blisters as well is, and I think particularly, I had a couple of bad ones. Danny had quite a few bad ones. I think the thing with blisters that people probably overlook sometimes is if you've got a big blister on, say, your big toe, you will compensate by trying to plant your foot on the outside to take less pressure off the big toe where your worst blister might be. But by doing that, there's a knock-on effect onto the next injury or the next pain, and you're sort of overcompensating. And yeah, we had some pretty horrific blisters, I think, between all of us. I still think Danny had probably the biggest and best ones, particularly the one that popped popped as he took his sock off in the reception of a hotel and basically burst, spreading some sort of goo across the floor.
Oh, no.
As you can imagine, the girl behind the desk kind of looked at us like, "What is that?"
No, that's ghastly. No. Where was that?
I have no idea. Probably, I don't know. What do you reckon, Danny, day four, something like that?
No, yeah, I think it was. I think that was the first blister I'd started to get, and I'd not even realised I had a blister. I just remember sliding my shoe off as soon as I sat down, and it just went everywhere. It popped and just went absolutely all over the reception.
Like, oh no, how ghastly.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I had blisters under blisters. You know, you pop one and there was another one there. I've never had anything like it.
It's a wonder you didn't get infected, but the blisters can get pretty toxic pretty quick.
Yeah, it is. It's mad. I suppose, looking back on it, we got quite lucky then.
Yeah, indeed.
All them blisters and we got lucky by not getting infection.
Yeah. So, Michael, let's go back to you. What about food? I mean, you can't eat rubbish if you're running every day for those kind of hours. How hard was it to find what you needed to eat? Or were you able to eat whatever the heck you wanted because you were running so far every day?
I think it was a bit of both. I think, yeah, sometimes it was challenging because, like Danny said earlier, we were kind of getting up early, and you know, the alarm would go off at 5:30, and then we'd be aiming to be out of the door on the way by 6:30 latest. You know, so nowhere's open at that time. So what we tried to do was buy some stuff the night before that we could eat as soon as we got up before we went out. So, you know, we try and grab kind of, and then along the way we try and grab stuff. There's an element of, yeah, you've got to eat the right stuff. But at the same time, you know, I think we were burning like between 6 and 8,000 calories a day.
Yeah.
Well, that's a lot of food to put back in. Yeah, so that's... I think the biggest challenge was volume. Like, it, you know, rather than the type of food, like the volume, like to try and put that many calories back in was difficult. And, you know, I gave it a real good go. You know, we were eating like donuts for breakfast and croissants and sandwiches and pizzas and all sorts. Like, but when you add it all up, probably still wasn't meeting the calories we were burning.
How hard is it to run with pizza in your stomach? I mean, seriously. I kind of think of it like you must be thinking, oh man, I wish I didn't eat that pizza last night. But you have to kind of feed. You have to kind of feed high carb diet, yeah, don't you, to get the energy out of it to keep going the next day.
Yeah, and I think that's where this is different to a, you know, a one day marathon or a one day ultra, where you probably can get by with, you know, energy gels, blocks, that sort of stuff. Mm. Like, you can't do that for 14 days. So you got to eat real food, you know, so, and you've got to be taking on real carbs to provide that energy. And I think, you know, I kind of experienced that when I did London to Paris. It was, I met a girl beforehand who had done 12 marathons in 12 days. And the biggest piece of advice she gave me that stuck with me was eat real foods, you know, and use it in your training. So when you're training and you're doing a long run, practice eating real food so that you get used to, you know, maybe doing 6 miles, stopping and having a sandwich or, you know, taking on some real food and then going again. So your stomach gets used to it, your body gets used to eating real food and then just carrying on.
Yeah.
You know, and to be fair, I think sometimes we'd stop for lunch and it wouldn't even touch the sides. So we'd just keep, and then we'd just carry on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. So, Danny, you reached out to me to tell this story and I was fascinated, to be honest. But I want to know now about the charity. How much money did you make? What was the motivation for the charity aspect of the journey? And how did that come up in the conversation between the three of you?
From a charity perspective, I mean, I'll talk about mine, let Michael and Tom talk about their respective charities and why they do what they do. But I've been fundraising for a charity called Murdered Abroad since 2018. So I lost a friend of mine. He was shot and killed in Berlin in September 2015. And then in 2018, I reached out to this particular charity, Murdered Abroad, who help families that have lost people abroad, basically. And they invited me down to a day that they get everybody together. And I sat there in the room and I said to myself that day, I'm going to try and raise as much money for this charity as possible. So, you know, I went out and did a marathon, then did another multi-day event. And every time you have to go one bigger, basically. Yeah. And then Gary reached out to me after speaking to a pal of mine and said that he was doing this event. And I was like, well, this fits perfect for me because I want to raise some money for Murdered Abroad again.
Murdered Abroad? You mean there's a charity that offers support because it happens so often?
You'd be surprised. You know, I sat there in a room with nine families in Cardiff in 2018, nine families. Some quite recent, some murders had taken place 15 years before and they're still going through court cases and investigations, trying to get to the bottom of what happened. These people need a lot of support and it's such a blunt charity. And the reason why they're called Murdered Abroad is so hopefully they'll pop up on Google when people search Murdered Abroad. You know, it's a real glum, hard-hitting name for a charity. Wow.
Michael, tell us about your charity.
Yeah, so I actually work for a charity. So I'm head of a charity called City in the Community, which is Manchester City Football Club's official charity. Wow. So obviously I wanted to, you know, raise some money for the charity I work for, as well as the other two amazing charities that Dan and Tom chose. And specifically the money that's been raised for City and Communities going into a program we developed about 2 years ago called City Thrive, which is all about supporting the mental health of young people in Manchester.
Tell me about Manchester. I'm intrigued. It's always been the north of England has been, and I'm a rugby league fan, so I know about how rugby league is perceived in northern UK. It's a tough place. The people up there are battlers. They've survived. Is there still that kind of toughness, or is there a softening? Why are you talking about a charity that needs to support people in a community that's always been pretty resilient, pretty strong, pretty tough?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'd say, yeah, there probably is an element of resilience and toughness. I think that probably stems back to, you know, the history of Manchester as a industrial town and city. But, you know, that like any cities, you know, it's the same in London. It's the same in, you know, a lot of major cities around the world. And, you know, even we have a sort of sister club in Melbourne, Melbourne City, and they have a community scheme. And it's the same there. You know, these are quite affluent cities with, you know, big property developments and things, but, you know, it's the stuff that you don't see, you know, and Manchester, like any other city, has very affluent areas and, you know, a thriving city centre, but it also has some of the most deprived areas in the whole country, you know, in terms of deprivation around health, physical health, mental health, unemployment, you know, drug and alcohol issues, antisocial behaviour, like, you know, there are a whole range of different factors of that deprivation that exist, you know, not just in Manchester, but in many of the major cities around the world. That's our responsibility as the football club, is to, you know, to support local people, whether they're young, old, with whatever challenges they are facing. So everything that we do is around improving the physical health, mental health, the inclusion of people, breaking down barriers and then creating employment opportunities for those people.
Yeah, and it's often in those communities where the perception is everything's okay, everything's fine, I'm tough, I can carry on through, I don't have any issues, everything's fine. That's where the deepest and most heartfelt issues occur. They're the people that need the most support, yeah. Wow,
yeah, crazy. Mental health is something that's, you know, mental health affects everybody. And particularly off the back of a global pandemic, young people have been affected the most in terms of their mental health, in terms of, you know, levels of anxiety or depression or loneliness and a whole range of other mental health issues. So what we're trying to do with this program is raise awareness of mental health and talk to young people, you know, give them the tools that they need to be able to have difficult conversations, let them know that it's okay to not be okay. And then off the back of that, we also provide clinical support for any young people who need that more sort of technical clinical support through our trained mental health advisors.
Fantastic. So Tom, what about your charity? Tell us.
I chose Macmillan Cancer Support, and it was, well, I think we've all had friends and family who've benefited from the support that Macmillan provide for people with cancer. You know, there's a lot of charities I could have picked, but I personally found that was one that's helped me and family and friends as well. So, yeah, it was what I chose to do.
Has cancer impacted you personally?
Not. I haven't had cancer, but my friends and family, of course, yeah. And I think it impacts everybody. And if it hasn't, it sure it will do.
Yeah, everyone knows someone that either has had a family member or a friend that's been affected, haven't they?
No question about that. Okay, gentlemen. One of the key parts of the Camino, and everybody listening right now, if they've walked the Camino or they're planning to walk the Camino, they all know about Cruz de Ferro. So let me go through each of you. Danny, tell me about the Cruz de Ferro.
So I'm going to let Michael tell you this. He would tell it better. But this was a point where everything just came together. And I just want to add, so the first week that we ran the Camino, we had a support crew of my mum and her boyfriend. So you asked earlier about were they, you know, medics or anything. They weren't. They were family that came over. They were not a professional support crew. In the second week, a gentleman called Phil took over as support. And it's his son that was murdered in Berlin in 2015. So again, another beautiful thing to this whole event, and another thing that kept us going each day. Because I know for me, that no matter how much pain I was in, no matter how much physical pain, the mental pain I was going through, I would look at Phil and I would think the pain that he's going through is nothing compared to what we're going through. Ours will be over in 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 days. It'll be gone and we'll be healing. He will wake up with a pain every single day that he can't get rid of. So this particular day, this was on day 10, I think it was. And Michael, I'm going to let you take over the story as well, because, you know, you had a poignant moment with the music that you was listening to. Tom, you had a moment as well. So I'll let you come in there.
Yeah, I think I obviously heard about this point of the route from Tom. And then, you know, I'm sure most people who are listening to this have watched The Way and seen, you know, the footage of it there. And we actually stopped for some lunch, and there was a lady who went past that we kind of crossed paths with a couple of times throughout the morning. And she said, "Oh, I've got my stone ready for tomorrow." So, you know, in my head, I'm thinking, "Oh, this point is coming tomorrow." What we didn't realize is she was a normal person who was walking 10 or 12 miles a day. And actually that lunch stop for her was the end of her day. So we then set off after lunch, and I said to these two guys, like, "Look, you guys crack on. I'm, you know, obviously moving a little bit slower. I'm going to put my headphones in." Didn't really listen to a lot of music along the way, but I said, "I'm going to put my headphones in. I'm just going to zone out for a bit." So I've just put a random Spotify playlist on shuffle, started running. And a couple of minutes later, we're on a little footpath. And as I turned the corner, I saw it. I saw the huge sort of mountain of stones, and Tom and Danny stood at the top. And on my playlist, just before I turned the corner, so I hadn't actually seen the stones at this point, was a song that came on. It's a stereophonic song called Maybe Tomorrow, which quite poignant for me, because I actually lost one of my best friends in 2007, and unfortunately passed away through leukemia. And his favorite song, and unfortunately also the song he chose himself for his funeral, was Maybe Tomorrow. So in my backpack, I have a stone at this point that I picked up on day one, and I'd written my message on there, which was, "Maybe tomorrow we'll find our way home."
And that song just came on.
Yeah, it came on probably
like
20 seconds before I turned the corner and see these guys up there. And I ran up to the top, and Tom's sat down and he's having, you know, a quiet moment to himself. And I said, "Mate, you're not going to believe this." And I took my headphone out and put it to his ear. And then I had my stone in my hand, and he's just looked at me like, "No way." And I was just like, you couldn't write it. It's, you know, it's crazy. It gave me goosebumps.
It was magical, wasn't it? Because Tom had had a moment as well. I'd got emotional at that particular point, and as you'd rocked up as well, we hadn't planned on stopping here at this particular point. We didn't know we were all going to be stopping. And as we were all having this moment, Phil, Luke's dad, drove up at that exact moment. So it's everything just came together at this one moment. It was unbelievable.
Gosh, that's just such a great story.
Tom, tell him about the 22.
Come on, Tom. Come on, Tom. I mean, I'm blown away, but come on.
I've always had, well, for years I've had this thing with the number 22. I see it, you know, people have this, they see it, certain numbers or things that just catch their eye. But this number 22 is really important to me, really. It kind of brings me back to the universe somehow, I don't know. But I took some of my dad's ashes with me on the Camino, and I planned to take some there and spread some ashes up there. And as I'd done that and I'd sat down and I was having my moment, I looked down to my feet and there was a tiny, when I say a tiny rock, it was probably the size of a...
Oh, it's about a centimetre.
Yeah, 5 penny piece, wasn't it? It was a tiny little white rock with the number 22 written under my foot.
Yeah, and I got up there and I was like, oh, Tommy, is that your stone? Like, assuming that he'd written a 22 on one, because that's, you know, I've known that's Tommy's number and he sees it everywhere and stuff. And he's like, no, I've got my stone in my pocket, look. And he pulled his stone out, where he'd written a message on it at home before we even left England. And I'm like, mate, look down by your foot and there's this little stone with a 22 on it. And I was just like, no way.
Wow. So why is 22 so important to you, Tom?
I don't know. It's just one of these things that caught my eye. And yeah.
How interesting.
All we had was Tommy pointing out 22 again. This is going to be a good day. 22 again. 22. You saw it everywhere, didn't we?
Yeah.
Wow, I wonder what that is in numerology. I must have a look into that. Yeah. How fascinating. Yeah,
but I think that after that moment, it was amazing, wasn't it? We just had this incredible
they were the most enjoyable days, weren't they, after that? Because it was like, you just kept looking. I think when we ran down the hill, I think I cried most of the way down the hill.
Oh, yeah.
I think all three of us did.
It was the most overwhelming experience of my whole life that day, that moment.
We'd been speaking about these kind of things, haven't we? Like coincidences and things.
Yeah, what was fate? What's coincidence?
Yeah. And then this happened.
And I think you're right, Dan. I think we all were probably in tears as we ran away from there, kind of separately. I think I went first. I was like, I've just got to go, guys. Like, and I sort of plodded along and I was just, I think it was almost a reality check and a reminder of like, this is why you're doing this. These people that we've lost are, you know, and were the reason really why we were doing it. Mm. And then that kind of makes it easier to push pain down because, you know, you're doing this for a bigger reason and a bigger cause.
Danny, I'll go back to you. What would you say to someone who's considering running the Camino?
God. It's a real tough one, isn't it? There were so many points where I wanted to give up. Then towards the end, as it came to an end, I felt this overwhelming feeling of emptiness because it was going to be over. So if I was going to say to anybody running it, let me do it with you. I'd love to do it all over again. I'd say some, you know, I miss the camaraderie of it. Getting up in the morning. Do you know what? The most painful part was the before the start and the end of each day. Because when you're on that path, it takes everything away. Like my favorite three pictures that I took was one of Tom in the morning bandaging himself up. He does not look happy. He does not want to carry on. I'm sure he would have done anything to get out of it. And then there is another picture of Geary after a day of running. He's lay on his bed. He's got his feet up. He's got ice taped to his swollen ankles. And at that particular point, I thought he would do anything to get out of this. But then there's a picture that I took on the path We've just got to the top of a hill. The sunrise is coming up. And it's a picture of these two taking a selfie with the sunrise in the background. And it's just a beautiful picture that says, you know, once you're out on that path and you're running it, the pain goes away almost. It's the before and after each day starts and finishes that's the killer when you stop.
Tom, tell us about arriving in Santiago de Compostela.
Well, I think it is very exciting. I think for myself, I think getting to day 10 or 11, that's when we kind of, I felt like we were going to get there and achieve it. But getting into, I think we all had our own things, didn't we, really? But
it's quite emotional, wasn't it? Yeah. Like, it was quite emotional seeing the cathedral, and it didn't really sink in, like, until, you know, we ran into the square, we all put our hands on the cathedral wall, and we sort of stepped back and sat down or lay down and collapsed onto the floor in front of the cathedral. It didn't really sink in that we'd actually done it and finished it and achieved, you know, an amazing challenge. I don't think that really sunk in for a good few days. For me, I don't think it really sunk in until I actually got home. And I went back into work, and everyone in the office was like, wow, like, what you guys have done is unbelievable. Can't believe you made it. Like, I think, yeah, getting to Santiago was a sense of massive achievement, a little bit of relief of what, like, that we'd actually made it. But yeah, amazing to come into the town and see the cathedral, and, you know, just to see all the other pilgrims get in there as well. And, you know, the place is buzzing. And then, you know, a very well-earned frosty beer for me and Tom.
Fantastic. Okay, now I'm going to ask, to finish up the interview, I'm going to ask each of you for a word, one word, that sums up your experience and why. Okay, so Danny, let's start with you. What's one word you'd used to describe the experience and why?
Beautiful. Surrounded by beauty. It's the beauty that gets you through it as well.
Tom?
Yeah, I'd say joyful.
And why?
It was all smiles. There's lots of pain, but it's great.
For me, I'd say challenging. And that's because that goes both ways. It's challenging and can be a, you know, it's not a negative, but it's a, you know, a difficulty of the challenge that it took to complete it. But also on the flip side of that, that's part of the beauty of the Camino, is it is challenging, and it's an opportunity for you to push yourself, to push your body, to find out where the limits are. You know, so that side of it being challenging, I think, is also one of the most appealing things for me. Is, you know, I think we all had a little bit of a sense of challenging is the appeal. Like, how far can we go and how far can we push it?
Danny, you reached out to me to do the interview and to have a chat. And I said immediately, straight away, absolutely, I'd love to talk to you. Do you know how much you raised?
As of today, without gift aid, we are, I think, at £13,803.
Goodness.
So if you take, yeah, so if you put the gift aid on that, we're close to £16,000, aren't we, Michael?
We're actually, on Just Giving, yeah, we had around that, but we also were pretty lucky to receive quite a few offline donations. So in total, we've got just over 20,000, and I'm just waiting on another donation, which is roughly about 2,000. So if that comes in the next week or so, we'll have actually raised over £22,000.
Wow. Well, what an extraordinary story. It's a unique story. Three friends who decided to take on an amazing challenge to run alongside one another And I can imagine it wasn't easy by any stretch of the imagination. It was incredibly difficult, in fact, but a pilgrimage of an entirely different form. And I've spoken to literally almost 300 people here. You're the first that I've spoke to who has run the Camino. It's a unique story. I really appreciate, Danny, you reaching out to join us on the podcast, but I'm so pleased and so proud to have had the opportunity to talk to you and to tell your story. Congratulations, Danny and Michael and Tom. Congratulations on what you've been able to achieve. And I hope there's plenty more journeys of discovery and philanthropy along the way. Buen Camino, gentlemen.
Buen Camino, Dan. Thank you. Thank you for talking to us. My girlfriend's officially banned me from talking about it, so this has been nice to talk about it again with you all.
How lovely. Thanks, fellows. Congratulations, and I hope our paths cross soon.
Thanks, Dan.
Cheers, Dan.
Thanks, Dan. Buen Camino.
My guests this week, Danny Nichols and Michael Geary, and Tom Pilling, who ran the Camino from Saint Jean-Pied-de-Port to Santiago de Compostela in 14 days. I began by saying we almost owe it to ourselves to make the most of the opportunities presented by pilgrimage, whether you were running or walking. If it is some sort of malaise that led you to the Camino, why not take the most of the chance for change? The former US President John F. Kennedy said, when written in Chinese, the word crisis is comprised of two characters. One represents danger, the other represents opportunity. So make the most of all your opportunities. Our thoughts especially to our family and friends in Spain and France in the wake of the heatwave and wildfires. We're thinking of you and praying for you. And a special thank you to Joe and Daniel, who signed up as Patreon sponsors this week. You can sponsor me too. Keep the podcast alive via patreon.com/Dan Mullins. Thanks for your company as always. I'm off for a run. Until next week, Buen Camino.